Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Thursday, March 3rd, 2022. This is the second edition of the AFP Report, a new podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. Today I am joined by Mark Anderson, an independent investigator and longtime reporter for American Free Press. Okay, Mark Anderson, welcome to the program, sir. How are you?
Very well, sir. Good to talk to you, John.
Yeah. This is a long overdue conversation and hopefully something that we can do somewhat regularly. You're a longtime reporter for American Free Press, and I know you've covered the Bilderberg meetings over the years and other globalist meetings and confabs. So just to get started, can you kind of give us a little bit details of your background and how you got involved in journalism and ultimately reporting for American Free Press?
Well, the very first involvement in journalism, briefly speaking, was in 1984-85. I'm a drummer by trade, and I was in a number of rock bands trying to make my living as a musician. And there was a couple weekly papers in Southwest Michigan that were coming to the house free or by subscription, I don't remember. But I was concerned about arms race issues. I got a little bit into that as an activist back in those days. I was like 24 years old. And I wrote a couple letters to the editor to these weekly papers that kept coming in the mail. And the editor called me up one day and said he liked my letters to the editor and that he needed a reporter. So I signed up for the Berrien County Record in Southwest Michigan. It was the oldest weekly of that county. I think it's still in existence, and it's still the oldest weekly in that county. It's the southwesternmost county in Michigan bordering Indiana. And so then I got into writing for that paper. I became editor over a course of about 6 or 7 years. And so I was just your typical small-town reporter writing for two weeklies that covered two different areas. Both of them were produced out of one office.
And oh, wow, that's interesting.
I was initially a photographer going to school events, sports, shooting football games, and I didn't get into writing till a little bit later, covering school board meetings. It was kind of funny. I didn't know how they calculated property taxes. I had to learn that on the fly. There was a lot of things going on that I didn't really understand. I was still kind of a rocker at heart. You know, it took a while to adapt to working full time after living a musician's life from when I was 16 or so until I was 24.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. Those were pretty funny days. And so I eventually developed the work ethic to go to work every day. Really, what's that about? And not sleep till noon. And so the years passed, and I, you know, got better at writing and started covering county government, occasionally state government, at least if a state rep or state senator came to the area. I didn't go to Lansing, the state capital of Michigan, in those days. But the state reps would come to the area. One I knew quite well. State Rep Carl Ganaki. He was a good guy who ended up being a skeptic of the UN, by the way, and was against the United Nations involvement in American affairs. And that sort of piqued my interest a little bit, you know. And eventually I started writing ad copy and regular news reporting, stock news reporting for the South Bend, Indiana Tribune, where Notre Dame is. And that was a good size. Daily paper. So I went from weekly to daily, and the Tribune was a liberal paper, but at least they tried to get things accurate, it seemed, in those days. And the photographic staff were good people, and I did a lot of photography still, because that was my initial thing that I was trained in. And things started happening because I was in a bigger city, South Bend, Indiana, so there was a little bit more going on at the college at Notre Dame. Hesburgh was there. Of course, he was a creature of the Rockefeller Foundation. And I began to hear things and learn things. And I started going through the files at the Tribune in the library and picking up on sort of the subculture, you might say, politically in greater South Bend. And I started picking up on the, you might say, the tremors of the establishment. There was Father Hesburgh. There was controversy at Notre Dame on other matters. And then eventually I met some members of the John Birch Society. who were in nearby Michigan and in South Bend, Mishawaka, Elkhart, these cities in northwest and north central Indiana. And a friend of mine in Florida, meanwhile, gave me a copy of a book called The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations and the American Decline by James Perloff. And by that time, I had been at the Tribune a few years. And so all of a sudden, I've got Birch Society materials coming to my house. I'm reading the Perloff book, and I'm looking a little bit at what I had learned in the Tribune's files, and I began to put together that the governance of the world wasn't exactly what we were told it is.
Wow. Man, that's an interesting story. John Birch Society, they were primarily like an anti-communist type organization, is that right?
Primarily anti-UN, anti-communist. Well, see, they figured that the UN Constitution was modeled, or the Charter, rather, was modeled on the premise that the Soviet one was. And it's true in the basic sense that human rights were not a God-given, inborn thing. They were granted by government, and they could be taken away. It's all in the language. And so the UN Charter and the Soviet Constitution, if you want to be so nice as to call it the Soviet Constitution, had that same premise that rights were negotiable and that they were just privileges.
Rather than granted by, you know, by the sovereign, by God, essentially, which is like the American tradition. Yeah.
Right, which is critical, because if a right can be taken away, it's not a right. You see?
Right, exactly, yeah. Sort of at the whim of who's ever in charge. And if they don't like what you have to say, well, they can take away your rights, which is what we're seeing very, very – it's very prevalent nowadays, it seems like, anyways.
Yeah, yeah. And so the Birch Society started having a lot of meetings. Well, they were already going on, especially in Elkhart. There was a gentleman named Al Foreman. I won't go into details, but he brought in some pretty heavyweight speakers. Charles Rice, the now late Charles Rice, professor emeritus of law at Notre Dame, was powerful. Whoa. And I learned a lot from him, so much so that he trusted me to fill in for him on a TV, a televised broadcast at a community college in Michigan. He was invited and couldn't make it. He had enough confidence to fill in for him and to talk about the social issues, the gay rights issues, and different trends like that. And I held my own against some radical leftists, pro-homosexual, pro-social engineering types, filling in for Charles Rice, of all things. This was about 2003, so I'm jumping ahead just a little. But working with him, although I didn't talk to Charles a lot, the time I did spend with him was quality time. He gave me a lot of his law review articles about the abortion issue, about social issues. And this is where I began to really learn about those issues and get away from the establishment view, you know, the view that anything goes and that human life is can be sacrificed for the greater good, for some nebulous greater good of the state. And he really set me straight, Charles Rice did, in the brief time that I knew him. And he did a cable show with me. I called it Beyond the Headlines. And these were the days when, and I was still working at the Tribune. This is the mid-90s when I first met him. These were the days when you could go to your local cable station and there was a franchise fee that was paid on people's cable bills, and that would fund a required outlet at any sizable cable station that they had to provide equipment and facilities if anyone in the local community wanted to produce their own TV show.
And public access television, right?
That's correct.
Which is how Alex Jones got started, I believe.
I think you're correct without looking it up. But anyway, long story short, Charles Rice was among my first guests on Beyond the Headlines. And that particular cable network was not the kind for its public access shows that got low viewership. They got relatively high viewership because it was a very densely populated area consisting of Mishawaka and South Bend, Indiana, primarily. That's a lot of households, hundreds of thousands of households. And I'm doing the show on my own time, my own dime, and it's about 1994. And the managing editor of the South Bend Tribune taps me on the shoulders. His name was Ed Perkins, and asked me to come into his office. And I thought it was something routine. He closes the door and harangues me for daring to put my own opinion on the air independent of the Tribune.
Wow.
Were you
presenting yourself as an employee or a representative of this particular newspaper, the Tribune, or were you, like you said, it sounds like you're pretty much doing it independently of your work at the paper, but was it known that you were, you know, a contributor and an employee of this paper?
Well, it wasn't stated on the show. I just said journalist and local resident, and it was my own time, my own dime. I was after hours. I wasn't supposed to be at work, and I wasn't spending any company resources to get there or be there. But his view, which wasn't altogether irrelevant, was that enough people knew me that they could put two and two together. What I told him was that at the time I was doing a niche publication for the Tribune up in Michigan, and it wasn't real high profile. I wasn't a police beat staffer who was being seen by the local police every day and the local sheriff and the local mayor. In other words, my beat was not the South Bend beat or the Mishawaka beat. It was up in Michigan because they had Michigan editions so close to the state line. So that was my comeback, but he didn't buy it. And they actually made me stop doing that cable show.
Wow. I thought you were going to say that and they let you go.
No, that later on, I ran for state rep. And I left the paper when I ran for office, the only one and only time I ran for office. But it was a learning time. And the paper was philosophically quite liberal, the South Bend Tribune. And I was becoming more conservative by the day.
Right. Yeah. Well, at the very least, it sounds like it would have been really good experience, you know. Just in journalism in general, learning how to write, learning how to put stories together, learning the process of actually printing a publication. Right. Yeah. Because there's a lot to it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And as a consequence, I know the whole kit and caboodle. I could start a newspaper of my own and put the whole thing together now because I worked in every department, advertising and even some distribution. And I would talk to the distribution guys. I'd talk to the press guys. And, you know, I learned the whole thing, top to bottom. And it's been a good, if not a lean way of making a living, it's been a good way of making a living. But, boy, you do not get wealthy.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm curious. So when did you start contributing to American Free Press?
About 03 or 04. To go back a little bit, in the mid to latter 90s into the early 2000s, I started actually writing for the New American, formerly known as American Opinion, which was the Birch Society's flagship magazine. And the editor liked some of my sample writings. And the first thing he had me cover, one of the first things in terms of coverage, I mean, there was a couple other articles I wrote that didn't involve going somewhere, but one of them was Mikhail Gorbachev spoke at the very same college where I had filled in for Charlie Rice a few years before that, for that social issues program. And I was on that televised panel discussion that I mentioned. Well, Gorbachev spoke there, and he had started the Gorbachev Foundation. And so the New American had me cover that. That was about 1997. And at that time, I had gotten back into the weekly, ironically, the Berrien County Record that I had worked at when I was younger. They were still going. They hired me back for a couple years. And at the same time, I wrote for the New American. And as time went by, some of the Birch Society members moved on or passed away, and I became less involved with them. I never got both feet in that organization. I was just learning from them and got to know some of their writers, William Norman Grigg, William F. Jasper, some really great reporters, by the way. And they also taught me some things. And anyway, so then I forget where I first saw American Free Press. It was probably at an event like a gun show or some political gathering where there were copies there. And this is the early 2000s. And the first story I wrote for AFP was about the Benton Harbor, Michigan riots. That's the town I was literally born in, Benton Harbor, Michigan. And there were riots there in 03 that were more, there was more than meets the eye in terms of what happened, in terms of what led to them and fostered them. And I wrote a pretty big spread. And that was my first article. I don't remember if it appeared in 03 or early 04, but it was right around that 03, 04 timeframe. And so that's when my first AFP article appeared.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. So you've been writing for the paper for almost 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And I know one of your big beats is the Bilderberg meetings. I know you've covered many of them in the past in person. I think the past 2 years, they haven't even actually had a physical conference due to the COVID pandemic. But I'm curious, like, what got you interested in that? I mean, it sounds like, you know, learning from like the Birch Society, for example, and learning about the Council on Foreign Relations, you kind of had a background in understanding these like globalist type organizations that were pushing for global government, pushing for, you know, like a one world system. So yeah, can you talk about some of your coverage of the Bilderberg meetings? When did that first start?
Well, I joined AFP as a full timer in 07, early 07, and I had already spoken, if I remember correctly, I'd already spoken to Jim Tucker a couple times on the phone, complimenting him and asking him about his Bilderberg coverage, which he started with AFP's predecessor, the Spotlight, in the mid 70s. And he came, like myself, Tucker came out of conventional journalism. He and I had that in common. And we would go to the National Press Club, where he had a membership, and sit and drink a few beers and talk about the news business. That was some of my favorite times. Well, we did that a few times in 07, 08. And here I am talking to Tucker, who a couple years before was just a voice on the phone. And of course, he was very funny and very intelligent, very witty. And he told me about Bilderberg and said he wasn't getting any younger. And he just basically tapped me to assist him in researching them, and from there in actually covering them, because he was, you know, getting a little older and slowing down a little bit. And he just figured that I would be sort of Bilderberg Jr. and that I would take over when he no longer could cover them. That's the way it went. And so he taught me everything he knew about Bilderberg, and how to cover them and some of these other think tanks. Which are what I describe are part of the Bilderberg network. Bilderberg is not a think tank. Bilderberg is a college of other think tanks. It's a meeting of entities more than it's an entity in and of itself. Bilderberg is really a set of meetings. It's a conference. It's not so much an organization, although there is a partial organizational structure there. Instead, it's a college or collage of other organizations.
I was gonna ask you, like, what exactly the Bilderberg group is, but yeah, that's kind of my understanding. It's basically the whole organizational purpose of it is just to organize these big meetings, right, where they invite people from the private sector, from the government sector, from, you know, all over the world to come together. They put together, you know, a meeting, an agenda. In the past, I mean, when Jim Tucker was, he was really like a pioneer in not only researching this organization, but exposing it and reporting on it. You know, it was for years, I mean, for up until probably the mid 2000s, it was considered this like crazy conspiracy theory that the Bilderbergs were meeting, when in reality, it was like a very real thing. And they, I mean, you can even go to the Bilderberg meeting website today, and, you know, they have like a list of all their past meetings and their agenda and some of the people that have spoken and stuff. And, you know, of course, the topics that they're discussing and highlighting. So, yeah, he was like really a pioneer in this. And now, you know, it's pretty well known. Look, yeah, the Bilderberg is this actual organization that's organizing these meetings. And many of your politicians are attending them and getting, from what I can tell, getting their talking points directly from, you know, these sort of globalist-minded organizations.
Yeah, that's the problem with it. And Tucker explained that to me. And of course, he got me really, you know, piqued my interest and got me salivating here. So the next thing you know, I had barely traveled except within the United States my whole life. Next thing you know, I'm in Spain, I'm in Switzerland, I'm in Denmark. And I'm like, how did this happen? You know? And, you know, I'm pretty much just a Midwestern dude, you know? And so, it was really fun too. Besides all the intrigue and the hard work, it was just plain fun. And, we, Jim taught me the tricks of the trade that I learned elsewhere, that I applied elsewhere, excuse me. And, one of the most interesting times was the 2014 Trilateral Commission meeting in Washington at the, what was that hotel? Gosh darn it. The Mandarin Oriental Hotel, right across the Potomac from the Jefferson Memorial. And what Tucker taught me really came into fruition at that particular meeting. I had never dreamed that I would be able to penetrate it the way I did. But that was quite the banner year. 2014 was kind of a banner year. Bilderberg met in Denmark. I got a lot of interviews from Swedish and Danish news outlets, most of them alternative, some of them more conventional. And the trilateral meeting that April, my favorite photograph is one I personally took of the now late Peter Sutherland, a big poobah with Bilderberg and Trilateral. And he was sitting in the bar lobby, and the Trilaterals were meeting that year. This is one of my favorite war stories of John. And they were meeting that year, and they didn't have all of their goings on and a gathering completely private. When they were in the bar, they were just mingling among the regular people. The same thing when they ate breakfast and things like that. So I walked in there, and I'm looking at them. And there's Jean-Claude Trichet, there's Paul Volcker, there's Peter Sutherland, and I'm thinking, man, there they are, right out in front of God and everybody, right? So I'm thinking about what Tucker had taught me and some things, and I just went in and decided to be a mole, because Tucker always said, if you get around them, don't make a big spectacle yourself, just go sit down, keep your mouth shut, and start listening. And, you know, gather some intel. Don't show yourself right away. And then if they can pick you out, then they'll get rid of you and you won't get any intel, right? So I sat there and kind of had my back to Sutherland and drank a little wine. And I didn't take any notes. I didn't want to do anything too obvious. I did have a recorder, but the background noise was a problem, including the music that they piped in, you know, the typical background music like you hear in a grocery store or something. So there was too much din to do much recording, but I got bored. So I listened in for a while, and right away I learned that they were going to have their next meeting in, I believe they said, Seoul, South Korea. I wouldn't have known that had I not went in there to be a fly on the wall, so to speak. So I didn't even have to dig for that one. Their meeting in Washington that year for their main meeting. And then I knew that they were going to meet in Seoul the following year. So right out of the starting gate, I got that information. And if you want, I can go to a little more depth on this experience. I think you might want to hear this.
Yeah, actually, I mean, one of my questions was, what was, you know, your most interesting experience over the years of covering, you know, some of these meetings? So yeah, go ahead, keep going.
This is by far, for me personally, the most interesting. One of the things was that when I didn't just listen to what they were saying as best I could, given all the limitations, some of the background noise, but I observed their behavior. You've never seen, John, people on the phone more than these people. They are constantly on the phone, sometimes two phones at once for one person, in groups, in little huddles most of the time, on the phone, on the phone, on the phone. And so that made it a little hard because there's all these conversations either person to person or on the phone going on. And so I decided after I listened in for a while just to observe their behavior. And they're so much on another plane intellectually and otherwise that you can do a lot of stuff that they don't notice. They're just sort of, they're like savants. They're really smart at certain things and really stupid at other things, if you follow me. I actually wondered whether these people actually put their own shoes on, or they were capable of doing it. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Honestly, they're savants. They're so taken up by their world and what they do to make their world keep going. It requires a lot of energy for them to do what they do. You can't fault them for hard work. They work their butts off. That's why they dominate. Okay. And so I decided to take some pictures of them because they were so sidetracked by what they were doing. And I'm taking every photo you can think of, and they're not noticing. I didn't turn the flash on. Tucker always said that. If you take your own photos, try not to use flash. I kind of knew that one anyway. But so I'm taking photos of Volker and whatnot. There was these little shelves where I could stick my camera, put the timer on the camera, and the camera would take its own photos without me holding on to it. And so I was having a good old time, you know, actually. And a couple of them kind of looked over their shoulder, and I acted like a tourist, you know. You just kind of play the accidental tourist, and they're so busy, they don't have time to inquire. And I walked up, I saw Jean-Claude Trichet, and he was holding this huge packet, kind of like a large city metropolitan phone book in thickness, only it was in a big, thick folder and some other papers. And he was clutching onto them like they were his child, like it would require gunpoint to get these papers away from this former member of the European Central Bank, Jean-Claude Trichet. And so I decided to have a little fun with him. I turned the flash on and hit him dead on, kind of at an oblique angle. And he turns and looks at me. I go, Jean-Claude Trichet. He says, yes. I go, I see the trilaterals are meeting today. It's on the marquee. Can you tell me a little bit about what you guys are talking about? And can I take your picture? And I felt like he didn't quite notice that I already took his picture. And so he goes, no, but then he kept going, and I am not making this up, John. He kept going, no, 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 no. And he said no like five times, like I was the plague, or like it was just out of the question that I would talk to him or take his photo. And I literally said to him, I said, what the hell is wrong with you? Right to his face.
Oh, wow.
Because he acted demented. Like maybe he hadn't had enough sleep, or maybe he had too much coffee, whatever the case, but he acted quasi-demented. I just laughed and just said, what the hell is wrong with you? You know, I just want to get a little bit of information. So I didn't mind revealing to one individual trilateral member that I was a reporter. I just didn't want to say it to a group of them. He was by himself more or less when I was talking to him. It was a big foyer, a big hallway, and there wasn't anybody immediately in our orbit. So,
wow.
It was bizarre. And not to dig too deep into this particular visit, but when I saw Peter Sutherland again, he was sitting in this chair, and it was only, keep in mind, this was only like 11:30 a.m., and this guy's on his probably second, if not third, large glass of red wine. It's not even noon yet. And I took his picture without a flash at a good distance, but it's one of my favorite photos. I keep it. I need to put it on my blog or something. But then I asked him if he could take his photo, and he said no. But of course, I already took it. You never ask permission. You get the photo, so you have at least one. And then if you ask and get permission, you take more. But if he says no, then you at least have something, right? So that's just the way you have to operate. And so it's one of my favorite photos. And then I proceeded to get in a debate with him about trade, more or less a debate. It was a discussion at first. And ironically, I just found the article in my files yesterday, John, that I had read right before I talked about trade with him. It was out of Politico. I believe, out of Politico. And I found it yesterday, and I still had it marked up from when I was talking to Sutherland back in April of 2014. And we got to talking about Trade, and I was like, I walked up to him and I go, Peter Sutherland. He goes, yes. I go, you've been a trade minister with the World Trade Organization, and you're here with this Trilat group, right? Yes. Sit down, boy. This is the way he talks. Sit down, boy. And so I sit down right across from him, and he's next to this French guy who could not speak even one word of English. This guy looked totally bewildered. But long story short, I talked about Trade for a couple of minutes with Sutherland. Then I thought, well, I'll never probably see this guy again. So I upped the ante, and I started getting a little bit more argumentative. And I was saying things like, why should Japan export most of their rice when they grow it? And any food is a perishable item. Why should they export rice, their top crop, a perishable item, and import rice from somewhere else? And he was trying to explain to me why that was a good idea. And I just kept kind of shaking my head and sort of looking at him sideways and indicating I didn't agree. And these people aren't used to talking to people that disagree with them, right? They live in this sort of rarefied atmosphere where they're only surrounded by their brethren. Okay. They're not used to any counterpoint at all. And I kept kind of upping the ante. And finally, he looks at me and says something along the lines of, who'd you say you were? And I said, well, I'm a writer. I didn't say reporter, I don't think. I believe I said writer. And I said, I kind of know Jim Tucker. I just sort of floated that name. I didn't elaborate too much. And he's sort of staring into space. And he looks at me kind of funny. And I think he recognized who Tucker was. And the last words he said to me, Peter Sutherland, he looks at me, he goes, I think we're done, boy. That's how he
ended
the conversation.
Oh, boy.
I think we're done, boy.
Now, Peter Sutherland, this is the Irish guy, right, that was involved in the UN and worked for the World Trade Organization.
Yeah.
He's sort of like, no, yeah. I just Googled his name. It looks like he's known as the father of globalism. So that should give you a hint of what this guy's all about.
Yeah. That was quite evident. He didn't like, and not that he was a dummy, but he was so doctrinaire. He was so steeped in his ideology that he just doesn't like coloring outside the lines at all. You know, I, as a reporter, I can consider his point of view. I can say, oh, okay, then you might have a point here. Not him, okay? They don't want to color outside the lines at all. That's part of the problem
is these globalists, and you know, they go to these meetings and they're all on the same page. They all have the same sort of ideology, and they don't receive any sort of pushback or criticism or an alternative perspective. I mean, imagine trying to justify Japan exporting their rice and then importing rice from Korea or something. I mean, it doesn't even make any sort of rational sense. And yet these people will jump through circles to justify it, all in the name of globalism, essentially. I mean, they're just totally dedicated to this ideology. And that's economic globalization. That's the free flow of migrants all over the world. I mean, there's many agendas behind this. There's many aspects of globalization. And these people are just totally fanatically devoted to this ideology.
Right. Yeah, because the what they describe as the free flow of people and goods. And remember, they consider people and goods synonymous. To them, a man is a hammer, is a boy, is a dog. It doesn't matter. A crate full of plums or a crate full of hammers or 12 people is all the same to these people. It's just commodities. It's people. People and hammers are the same to them, to the globalists. We're just all a commodity. That's just how it is.
Right. And so, it's a very like materialistic understanding, yes, of the world. Yeah.
Very godless, very materialistic. So he was basically trying to say that, you know, they broker these deals going back and forth. So really, what he really meant was money is to be made and cheap labor is to be had if you follow it his way. If you follow it my way, you might have, God forbid, a nation protecting some of its economy through tariffs, and that country might grow strong and might decide to be independent of people like Sutherland, you see. But it got even more interesting, and I'll give it in broad brushstrokes. After a lot of them had left the bar, remember, not all of them drank a lot, but Sutherland did, but a number of them were drinking early in the day like that, and a lot of them got up and left. I didn't think anything of it. A waitress walks up to me. She goes, do you know these guys? I go, Oh, I laughed. I said, no, these are millionaires and billionaires and trillionaires from this group that's mentioned on your marquee over there, the Trilateral Commission. She goes, most of them didn't even pay their bar tab.
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding me?
No.
These people are so despicable.
I know. And so then I remember something else Tucker taught me. Get the help of the help. Always enlist waiters and waitresses to be your spies for you. And so I didn't know how long. This was not the first day they were meeting at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel. And I didn't know, even though I knew I was coming back the next day, I didn't know if I could come back the day after that. And so I didn't go real far with it, but I did tell the waitress, you know, keep your eyes peeled. And I mentioned Jean-Claude Trichet's papers that he was clinging on to so hard, like I mentioned. And I described Trichet to her and a couple other waitresses. I said, if he lets go of even one piece of paper, here's my phone number, right? Or a USB drive. They find a USB drive discarded or anything. Anything at all. Let me know. And they agreed, and they were kind of venting, and you know, they barely leave any tips, and they didn't pay their bar bill. And later on, I found out allegedly that they paid the bill collectively from somewhere else, supposedly, because they thought the bar was part of the restaurant. But if you were there, you'd realize the bar was probably 60 or 70 feet from the entrance of a totally separate restaurant that had two big double doors on it. And any average layman would know that that bar was a separate entity. But somehow the Trilats did not figure that out. But the other highlights, as time went along there, and once I knew that I probably wouldn't see him again, another thing I found curious was they met downstairs in the big ballrooms. The ballrooms that they were in were in the basement, the lowest level. And there was this big flight of stairs, and I found it curious that they didn't put the do not cross tape at the top of the stairs. In fact, there was none there at all. And there was also an escalator there, so I was actually able to go down to their level. And the only thing that separated me from their meeting was the big double doors that were locked and had guards on the inside of those doors, not standing outside, but standing inside where you couldn't see them. And I thought, well, that's curious. You know, you'd think they'd put the tape at the top of the stairs. And then I thought, well, maybe it has to do with a fire code or something, right? So I didn't think much of it. And I'm seeing other people. I saw John Deutsch, former head of the CIA. I said hello to him, kind of acted like a starstruck tourist and this and that, you know, just kind of plying my trade. And I picked up a Washington Post at the counter, just to have something to set my food on and to read when I had time to kill, because I was going to wait for their meeting to get out and see who I could talk to once they took a break on that. I think it was a Saturday that day. And so I go down the stairs again. I had been up and down the stairs a couple times, and I walked down this hallway that had these chairs, these backless chairs on them, that went to some of the other rooms that they were not using. And I don't mind saying this now because it's been, you know, 8 years ago, but I looked down and there's one of their packets, the whole thing.
Just wow, laying no there. No kidding.
Yeah.
You got a hold of it?
Yeah. It's funny. I said, what would Tucker do? Right? Almost like, what would Jesus do? What would Tucker do? I looked at the Washington Post in my hand, and I hesitated for a second, and then I just grabbed the packet, which was about an inch and a half thick, folded it in the Washington Post, and as slowly and normally as possible, walked up the stairs and left the hotel. And it belonged to Jamie Serra, the North American chairman at that time, who was a Spaniard, I believe. It had to do with Russian containment and how to handle Russia. I still have it. And
interesting. Okay. That seems to be a common theme at a lot of these meetings. How are we going to contain Russia and China, and of course climate change and sustainability? Those are like the key, like a lot of the key agenda items that they always seem to have.
Right. One of the things was, however, it also had agendas and name lists. And from that, I learned that John Kerry, then Secretary of State, was sneaking into that meeting.
Yeah, unbelievable. I mean, and this stuff is going on. It's not being reported. You know, we have our top government officials hooked up with these international globalist organizations, you know, meeting behind closed doors. You know, it's how is this right? How is this legal?
Exactly. And I didn't know at what point, if and when they'd find that packet missing. So once I got outside the door of the hotel, and it was getting late anyway at that particular time, I wanted to get out of there anyway. Once I was sort of out of sight, I ran at a rather good clip. And I hadn't ran in a while. I just wanted to get some distance between me and the hotel because I didn't know when they'd find, if and when they'd find the packet missing. So I ran a good, probably 300 yards at a pretty good clip, and I got more winded than I thought I would. And this kid at the top of the subway entrance, he points to me, he goes, "Mommy, Mommy, I think this guy's having a heart attack."
Oh, no.
And I said, "Don't worry, kid. It's okay." And then I went down into the subway, and I didn't want to get that thing out and start reading it, but I couldn't resist. And I called Julie at the AFP office, and I was headed that direction. And it was a Saturday. Now I know it was a Saturday because I said, "Julie, I got a hold of a trilateral packet in a classic Tucker maneuver. I know it's a Saturday, but you're going to drive out of Maryland into the district, and we're going to make 3 copies of this thing." And she's like, "Oh, my God, Mark. Okay." She begrudgingly says yes. So an hour later, she's there, and we're in the office, and I'm resting, drinking some water. We're at the AFP office that used to be at 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. And I'm telling her about my experiences, and she's laughing and everything. And that copy machine is just going around the clock, just zit. And I think she was double-siding it so we wouldn't use so much paper. But at any rate, that was quite an experience. And the final day that I was there, I took some AFP articles and went into the bathroom that they were using the most, and I wallpapered the bathroom with AFP articles that they were using the most.
Oh, wow. So these people knew. Yeah. So they knew who was there covering them. Interesting.
Yeah, it was like I thought of it as the Mark of Zorro. And
right.
It was just too much fun. And,
that's cool, yeah.
Yeah, I figured I'd never see him again, you know, that nothing like that would ever happen again in those exact circumstances. So nothing really became of it. A few years later, the document that I grabbed appeared online. I don't know if that was covering their tracks. It might have been a year later, actually, that I think about it. But there was some rather sensitive information in there, mostly the agenda and the people thing. The article about Russia was somewhat sensitive. I mean, I don't think they wanted the general public reading it. It wasn't as explosive as I thought it was, but it was very detailed. And it definitely had it seemed to have the intent of keeping Russia under the saddle. Broken on the saddle of the globalists. In other words, to not really allow Russia to have true independence. And what do we see now? Although you wrote a story about it, there's a lot of fakery going on. There's a lot of unexplained anomalies, but we see what appears to be a Russian quote unquote invasion. And I don't think that's the right word.
No. Well, Putin's always, when Putin's talking about it, he's repeatedly referring to it as a special military operation. And that appears to be exactly what it is. They're being very strategic with how they're going about it. See, and the problem is now, like, you literally can't trust anything you're seeing reported, especially with all the fakery we've already seen easily demonstrated thus far. I mean, there's been so many fake stories, fake videos, fake photographs. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So it's really hard to really get an understanding of what exactly is going on. There's a guy that I follow on YouTube. I just recently came across him that's actually in Kiev. And he's been doing like live streams and talking about it. And it sounds like they're, you know, he is hearing and seeing like explosions and stuff and bombings, but it's not anything, you know, like you would expect. It's not like a full scale invasion, you know, like American troops going into Iraq or something. It's very, very different. But yeah, no, I wanted to ask you because that does seem to be like a major theme of like all these globalist events. I'm actually looking at, you can go to bilderbergmeetings.org. And, you know, this is their official website, I believe, anyways.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's got like a background tab. It's got a meetings tab where you can go back and look at all the meetings they've had, where they've been located, the dates, and the topics. And like I said, you know, it seems like Russia and China are always on the agenda, as is climate change and sustainability and, you know, I guess like the more broader like Agenda 2030. The Sustainable Development Goals of the UN, they're all sort of interrelated. So these are all topics that are always on the agenda. They're always focused on them. And it seems like more than anything, these groups operate to, well, one, not only groom future leaders of this like globalist agenda, but also to get everybody on the same page and to establish talking points. So these global leaders that do attend these conferences can then go out and sort of set the tone for their country or for whatever organization that they're operating in.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, they take what they learn and what they're in some cases probably assigned to do, but certainly encouraged to do, and they apply it in their particular polity or political entity.
Or corporation. That, there's a lot of like CEO, like, you know, private sector
right.
individuals. There's even a lot of, you know, like academics and journalists and pretty much any sort of influential leader in society is going to be attending these sorts of events, especially at the highest levels. And yeah, I mean, it seems like they sort of get their talking points and they're all on the same page, which is why, I mean, for example, like with this COVID-19 situation, I mean, how do you have literally the entire world all saying the same exact thing and all implementing basically the same exact policies? It's because we have this globalist system where these leaders are groomed and they get their talking points and they get their, you know, they get their marching orders, essentially.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I just wrote an article for AFP that didn't happen to make this latest edition. It'll go in the next one. Ironically, John, that talks about some elements of that, and that's the Young Global Leaders YGL program of the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum, of course, is this Davos, Switzerland jet set outfit in eastern Switzerland run by this almost Bond-like figure. You can imagine him petting a cat and just having a wry grin. Klaus Schwab.
Like the living embodiment of Dr. Evil, yeah.
Yeah, how does this happen, right? Art imitates life, etc. But he said, and he was quoted by a writer from globalresearch.ca, Schwab was quoted as saying that he's penetrating the cabinets of Canada and other countries are being schooled by the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum is functioning as something like a upper graduate school and indoctrination program for people in high places who are members of the cabinets of the various governments. And so you've got Bilderberg, where people from the private and public sectors and royalty and economics and academia, journalists that cover it, or journalists that attend and don't cover it, you know, they betray their own trade. And a quick footnote is in the 2019 Bilderberg meeting at Switzerland in Montreux, the Washington Post was trying to write about the Bilderberg meeting in Switzerland objectively, and then it was determined that the Washington Post had two people participating at the same time. Can you believe that? A couple different writers writing as if they're just being objective journalists, and at the same time the Post has two people participating in the meeting. How can that pass any journalistic smell test in terms of any journalistic integrity, right? Incredible. And I wrote that in some of my articles. But anyway, back to where we were. Yeah, they get together everybody, according to their function in society, gets their version of the talking points, and they apply it at their corporation, or they apply those talking points in their government or their academic setting or their journalistic, so-called journalistic setting. And this permeates everything. And then you have these school for statesmen, you might say, for people that have cabinet positions in particular, the most influential, coming out of the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum and Bilderberg are basically two sides of the same coin. Many of the people that attend one attend the other. You see, so they're kind of like siblings.
Right.
So
it's part of like this broader globalist network. I mean, you know, you got the Bilderberg Group, you got the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations. You've been writing about the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, or I guess it's Foreign Affairs, I believe. And they have this big forum on global cities, which is funded and sponsored by the Pritzker family in Illinois, who are, you know, big time into politics in Illinois. They funded Obama's, you know, campaign when he first got started in politics. So they're very influential behind-the-scenes player. Not even necessarily behind-the-scenes. I mean, J.B. Pritzker is the governor of the state, and they've got all sorts of people involved in politics. But they're funding these sorts of globalist organizations. And, I mean, you know, they even have this forum on global cities where, you know, that was an interesting article. That actually appeared in the issue 910 of American Free Press. So it would have been the last published issue of the newspaper. And I thought that was a pretty interesting article. What is this idea? I mean, what do they mean by global cities? How do they sort of frame this?
Well, one way of explaining it, John, would be go back to 2018 and Ivo Dalder, the president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which used to be called the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations until 15 years ago when they changed their name. They're celebrating their centennial this year in 2022. The original New York CFR celebrated its centennial last year in 2021. And these are more or less ideological soulmates, these organizations. But Ivo Dalder, the president of the Chicago Council, goes to Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, in the shadow of Buckingham Palace, right in the power seat of London. I've been there at Chatham House. I've been to that one. And he goes there for a meeting, and the topic was, should cities have diplomatic powers? And should cities have a seat at the table in diplomacy and foreign relations? And the general consensus, more or less, was, yes, they should. And the idea of what I've gleaned from this, I started covering the Global Cities Program in Chicago in 2016, and that was the very first one they had. So I got it right at the beginning. I was in Michigan, in Southwest Michigan. I could just go on a train around the lake, and the train got off right across the street from their meeting place. So boom, I'm there every time I can be there. This is before COVID. So I'm going to a number of their meetings, just being sort of, again, the hapless, interested member of the public and listening in, mouth shut, ears open. And the first one was at the Chicago Art Institute in the auditorium there. And that was in 2016. And what I've gleaned from that ever since is that they want to, draft cities into the world of globalism and sort of nudge them away from the loyalty or any allegiance they might have in their home countries. So the cities, because cities have a lot of political power, you know, the mayors, some financial muscle and whatnot, the cities can become sort of quasi-independent entities and would slowly but surely begin to operate independently, incrementally, but independently from the nations that they geographically inhabit. So
right,
they would empower them with diplomatic powers. They would allow them to be sanctuary cities and to thumb their nose at the central government and say, you know, we don't believe in your hatred of foreign people. And, you know, you just dislike foreigners, and you don't want people, you don't want them here illegally because you hate them, and all this, you know, this ridiculous stuff. And so a lot of them, Libby Schaaf, the mayor of Oakland, I'm not sure she's the mayor of Oakland, California anymore. She went so far, she attended some global cities programs. She went so far as to actually warn illegal immigrants, illegal aliens in Oakland when the feds were coming and actually tip them off to evade arrest and deportation.
Unbelievable. And this is the way these people are. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's all about undermining national sovereignty and destructing, you know, any sort of national identity, even. I mean, that's a big part of it. And I think that's largely been accomplished at this point. But yeah, no, it's incredible. And it seems to also tie into the, like, Agenda 2030 sustainable development type agenda as well, where they want they want to develop these cities into quote unquote smart cities, where everything's connected to the internet and that sort of thing, right?
Exactly right. Everything from mass transit to buildings that are energy independent in and of themselves. In other words, buildings that would generate their own energy, maybe through solar, wind, or other means. And taken individually, there's a lot of ideas for transit, for transport, and different living styles, different living arrangements that are intriguing. They're not all bad ideas in and of themselves. I don't mind mass transit. I would like clean, efficient trains and not always have to drive my car. But the problem is the context. The context is about control and centralization of power. I can take or leave certain individual ideas, you know, more park space, more green space. Some of that's not necessarily bad, right? But again, you put it together, you look at the context, and then you see that it's really about centralized control. And yeah, smart cities, so you'd have a lot more surveillance. You'd have probably scanners where eventually you could walk in a building and you'd walk through a scanner and right away it would know whether you've had the COVID jab or not. And maybe that would red flag your name and your account number, and then you would be penalized for not obeying some societal rule. You could see where this would go, right?
Right. It's like a very dystopian, technocratic future that these people want to build, and they're working overtime to do it.
Right, and you sense how materialistic they are, that they don't have any real redeeming spiritual values. There's no men of the cloth at these gatherings whatsoever. There's no clergy. There's no deeper look into what's right and wrong in terms of ethics and morality. It just isn't there. To them, it's all pragmatism and real politic and who has power over whom, who has the most missiles, who has the most tanks, who has the strongest army, who has the strongest navy, who has the largest GDP. That's what it's about to them. Nothing more, nothing less. And so, yeah, global cities would maybe be cleaner, more efficient cities in a way, but they'd also be more dystopian, arguably, and more surveillance-oriented. I even saw a movie where buildings, the building would have a sensor in it, and the building would know who you are, and there'd be a voice, and the building would say, "Welcome, Mr. Friend," and that building would know that you're supposed to be there. This was in a movie, but, you know, maybe that's predictive programming.
Right.
And they talk a lot about equity, you know, that they also want the cities to provide better jobs for people that are disadvantaged. And they want cities to be a place where people can, you know, make a good living and things like that. Use the mass transit, cut down on emissions because we got to worry about climate change. So everybody has to lower their carbon footprint. This is constantly stressed over and over again. And that's where the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs of the UN 2030, that's where that comes in.
Right. Well, they definitely don't want anybody owning their own vehicle and having that sort of independence. Yeah. You also see, and you see this all over the country, these policies at it's not even necessarily like these big global cities. You see this in suburbs and medium-sized cities and, you know, in all sorts of cities all across the country where they're like outlawing private residential zoning now to where, you know, you can, like, if you're going to build on an area, it can only be, you know, like high-rise apartment buildings, you know, mass structures that are capable of holding massive amounts of people rather than individual family homes. So it's almost like they want to, you know, you see this, they're pushing everybody to be living in like these little tiny apartments and, you know, ending sort of like the American dream where you own your own home and that sort of thing. Again, to fight climate change. It's all tied into that same narrative.
Yeah, that was evident at the very first Global Cities movement when Dan Glickman, the former Ag Commissioner, Agricultural Secretary for the U.S., was one of the first speakers there and talked about supposedly there's these trends where by 2050, like 70% of the human population, 60 to 70%, I don't remember the exact numbers, but a large percentage of the human population by the year 2040, 2050 would be living in cities, according to these studies that the council, the Chicago Council and other people would bring up. And so people would move into the cities and live in what you're referring to, John, and they call it stack and pack.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a very, like I said, very dystopian future they have in store. You know, I wanted to wrap up here, and I want to talk about one last article that, again, appeared in the previous edition of the paper, issue 9 and 10, a really good article you wrote about the border control, or I'm sorry, the border crisis, which has really taken a back seat. I mean, especially, you know, with COVID going on and now this Ukraine-Russia situation, it's something that's kind of been ignored and downplayed in the media, but it's really a huge crisis. The headline is, "Bipartisan Border Betrayal Continues. Texas National Guard Border Patrol not patrolling key border hotspots." And you actually interviewed a woman down there in Texas who's sort of on the ground observing all of this. And she had some really incredible things to say about how these law enforcement officials, whether it's the Texas National Guard or the Border Patrol, in many cases, they're actually facilitating these people invading our country and help, you know, essentially helping them rather than detaining them and deporting them as they should be.
Yeah. Here in Texas, where I live a good part of the year, and I right now where I'm sitting is about 7 miles from the border. I'm in the Rio Grande Valley, Hidalgo County. And a gentleman named Wyatt Watson, who's with the Texas Nationalist Movement, tipped me off to some people, including Frank Lopez Jr., who was with the Border Patrol for 30 years. He's retired now. And his acquaintance, the Sheena Rodriguez you're referring to, he said, don't listen to Abbott, Governor Abbott of Texas. Don't listen to the politicians. Talk to these people that are on the border as much as they can be and that are watching this thing. And I myself, John, I do go to the border myself when I can. It's not as easy as it sounds, and you got to know when and where to do it, and you got to be very careful. At any rate, Sheena especially, but Frank Lopez Jr. also, the Border Patrol retiree, had done extensive on-the-ground work. I mean, really getting in the weeds, really getting in the ditches, and they gleaned from that and witnessed it directly, what I wrote in that AFP article you're referring to, that Governor Abbott is putting Texas National Guard and state police in highly visible areas to look good to the public. But when you actually know the hotspots where the people are mainly coming over the border, you generally don't see those forces there to defend our country. And when you do, you see a few National Guardsmen here and there, maybe not at the hotspots, but maybe near them, helping people off the boats from the Rio Grande River. Helping them get into the country, not handcuffing them, not detaining them, at least not enough. I think there were a few exceptions, but by and large, facilitating this. And Governor Abbott just won the primary. The primary election here was yesterday or 2 days ago, March 1st. Today's March 3rd. And he evidently won the Republican nomination to seek the governorship against Beto O'Rourke. And Abbott is trying to sell himself as the border hero who took over for Trump when Trump got bumped out. And people like Sheena are crying foul and saying Abbott's lying. He's just not telling the truth. He's misrepresenting it. He's acting like he's tough on the border just for applause points, for applause lines. And he's just being a slick and slippery politician. And they showed me video evidence of what they were talking about. And unfortunately, besides the really liberal Democrats, John, that are allowing this border breach, you have something that's almost worse, and that's people that claim they're against the border breach, but are actually facilitating it, or at least not doing anything serious to stop it. And that, of course, is the RINO, Republican in name only. And that's really the blight on Texas right now, as well as other border states, I suppose, along this 1,900-mile border with Mexico. But that's the real problem, is the people that claim they're doing something and they're not.
Right, exactly. Well, I wrote a piece about Arizona's attorney general issuing that legal opinion, basically saying that, look, the state has the authority under the Constitution to actually defend and protect its borders if the federal government is refusing to. And that's what's been happening for a very long time, especially since Biden's been in office. But even under Trump, the whole border situation was a mess. But still, you know, the Republican governor doesn't seem to want to act on this legal advice, and not much is being done. In fact, in many cases, it seems like the people that are supposed to be protecting our borders are actually facilitating the invasion of our country.
Yeah, it's quite distressing. You know, we're dealing with this COVIDocracy, the bureaucracy that's grown up around COVID. I call it the COVIDocracy. And they're, you know, trying to severely limit the movement and freedom of people, especially medical freedom, but freedom in general. The worst attack, the worst threat against our constitutional freedoms that we've probably ever seen and probably ever will see. And then now we have to deal with a border breach at the same time, really? And then do I even need to say that if COVID is really so bad, why would you entertain for even one moment having a open or porous border? I mean, that's such a contradiction that it almost defies comment. And so, you know, at the end of the day, when you see this kind of border breach and you see what's going on, You almost have to conclude that the people in our government simply don't work for us at all anymore. They are literally working for somebody else. And they just put on a good show. They have elections. They make everything look normal. I write a lot about election theft, too. Maybe we can cover that another time, about voter GA, particularly in Georgia, where Garland Favorito, voterga.org, trust me, he's got a handle on it there. There really was November 2020 election fraud. And in Georgia, they're really bringing it out. And the mass media cartel is just moving heaven and earth to cover that up. But we'll save that for another time. But you just see what's going on, and you just have to conclude that our government officials are simply working for other people. The billionaire set, the trillionaire set, the internationalist set, whatever you want to define it as, has basically trumped the government. The certain private sector powers have acquired control of our governing infrastructure. It can't be denied.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. I completely agree. And it's, you know, these Bilderberg meetings and these other globalist, you know, conferences and whatnot, this goes to the heart of it. This is where a lot of this originates. And it's frankly outrageous. I mean, it's really outrageous what's going on in this country, and it's sad. I mean, these politicians are just total sellouts and traitors.
Yeah. To summarize, the mass media cartel, another phrase that I coined, is really the clear and present problem. If we had to name something for a solution, if we wanted to start having a remedy, we have to, above all, as citizens, as citizen journalists, as alternative journalists like you and I, John, we have to increase the scope and dissemination and distribution of the podcasts and articles and everything that we do, because the mass media is losing viewership. They are losing readership. They have been for a long time. They just need that final nudge. The real gold now is not gold in Fort Knox. It's not gold in the bank. The real gold right now is the narrative. Above all, the holy grail, John, is the narrative. That is what we have to win. You win the narrative and you'll win not just a battle, but the war. It's right. An information war now. And that's where it's at. The mass media cartel can punish whatever few good politicians come along, protect the bad ones, and keep a state of fear and uncertainty going on at all times. We see it worse than ever with COVID, and now they're bringing back the old Cold War narrative. Here come the Ruskies, and they're going to pump that narrative for all it's worth. There's going to be a lot of fakery, a lot of exaggeration, a lot of misrepresentation, a lot of deception, anything to make us feel like we could be blown up in our beds at any moment, and we might have to go to war because Putin doesn't put up with homosexuality, so we have to go topple Russia or some canard like that. But I don't know how long you want to go tonight, John. I'll kind of digress now, but that's the thing. We've got to get that narrative. The information war is the war to win. You win that, you get a hold of that, and I think the rest will follow.
Yes, absolutely. Very well said. I could not agree with you more. That's really the big problem, is the media's ability to control the narrative. I mean, it's sort of been slipping over the years. I think Trump played a big role in discrediting a lot of the mainstream mass media,
right.
But it's still a huge, huge problem. You're exactly right. And these people that control the media, they know how to scientifically manipulate the masses. I mean, they're pros at this. They know how to systematically deceive people, and, you know, to they can flip the script. I mean, think about it. For the past 2 years, it was COVID nonstop. Now it's like they flipped on a dime, and now it's all anti-Russian propaganda, pro-Ukrainian propaganda. It's incredible. It's incredible the way they can pull this off and get so many people to blindly go along with it. So I mean, I agree. I think that's been the main problem, is the mass media and people just blindly buying into it and not really thinking for themselves. That's the biggest problem.
Yeah, I mean, Rick Wiles of True News, based in Florida, he's probably not the only one, but he came up with this video that the current leader of Ukraine, not long ago, you can tell that by the way he looks that it wasn't long ago, did a kind of cross-dressing video where he danced in lingerie and high heels.
Yeah, I saw that the other day, yeah.
Yeah, now, I know that's kind of puerile and kind of like escapist entertainment almost, but I still think the American taxpayer has a right to know that this is the august leader that we're supporting.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I mean, the guy is literally a Jewish actor who played the role of a Ukrainian president in a TV show prior to being installed as the actual president of Ukraine. The whole thing is just one big script, essentially, it seems like.
Yeah, I understand he has an IMDb page.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, he was for years, from what I understand anyways. He was a comedian and an actor, and again, I mean, he literally played a Ukrainian president in a TV show prior to becoming the president of Ukraine. And it's just, yeah, oh yeah, yeah, check it out. It's almost unbelievable.
Surreal.
But no, you're right. I mean, you know, we've made some progress, but we definitely got a lot more to do. And I want to thank you very much, man. I appreciate it. This is long overdue, and we'll definitely have to schedule another one in the next couple weeks.
That'd be great. Yeah, look, we'll talk about election theft.
Yeah.
The way the media is manipulating that, I'll leave you with a cliffhanger, is so diabolically pathetic. It's the stock way, it's the conventional way that they skew the narrative. But the way they're doing it with election theft is particularly pernicious and particularly deplorable. And we'll get that next time, among other issues. So thanks a lot, John. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, take care.
Okay. Bye.
Good night.